And welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org, and we're on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, March 6th. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guests today are memoirist Vanessa McGrady and mystery novelist Glenn Eric Hamilton. First up is Vanessa McGrady. She was born in Manhattan, raised there and on the Washington State's Olympic Peninsula. She holds a BA from New York University and is a former radio and newspaper journalist, waitress, playwright, actor, bartender, dating service owner, and corporate communications and social media strategist. She writes about personal finance, feminist parenting, and health, and her work has appeared in the New York Times, Oprah.com, Jezebel, Forbes, Refinery 29, Bust, and elsewhere. She lives in LA with her daughter Grace Magnolia. And the book that is the focus of our talk today is Rock Needs River, a memoir about a very open adoption, published by Little A. And this is sort of the first time I've been speaking today, so please excuse all my oral glitches. Hi, Vanessa.
Good morning. How are you, Barbara?
I'm great. Let's talk about Rock Needs River. Talk about how the book came about.
Well, you know, I've always been a personal essay writer, and I always use that to make sense of whatever is happening to me at the time. And I had invited my daughter's birth parents to stay with us when they became homeless. She was about 2.5, and they, you know, we had a relationship with them, and they ended up getting evicted from their place and living in a tent. So they stayed with us, and I wrote about that experience for the New York Times, and the story just kept going, and it seemed like it had more and more life to it. And then I really felt compelled to write about family, not just our relationship with them, but also what led up to me having a family. It took a really long time, and then what happened after they left as well.
So I remember, I think it's almost 2 years maybe, or maybe it's more than 2 years, when we were out in the desert on a little ASJA retreat at Casa Cody, and you were working on something, and I thought it might have been this book, or maybe it was the essay that led to this book. Do you remember that?
It was this book. Yeah, I actually did endless drafts of this book over the last 4 or 5 years, and I cannot even tell you how many drafts we had. My agent is wonderful, and she was really deeply invested in the book, and she, you know, would take a look at it and say, "I know that I asked you for something, but this isn't it." And so I would go back and keep writing. And so, the time that we had in our little retreat was working on one of those drafts.
So then, you know, prior to that, did this begin with a proposal, or did you write the full manuscript, or once you published the essay, did you have, did the agent seek you out, or how did that go?
Yeah, shockingly, I signed with the agent on the strength of an email. And the essay in the New York Times. So I thought maybe it could be an e-book or something longer. So I sent it to someone at SheBooks, which is a geared for women, and it's by veteran magazine editors and writers. And they accepted it. And then they said, "Oh, actually, sorry, we're not taking new submissions, but what you should do is this should be a real book, and you should contact this agent." So I contacted the agent, and she said, "Not right for me, but my friend Cheryl is waiting for you." So I wrote to Cheryl Pienka and had a wonderful talk with her about the book, and she liked the story, and she did her thesis on open adoption. She's adopted, so she was really invested in this world, and she signed me without even a proposal or a manuscript, just on the strength of a chapter or so. So I was really fortunate in that way that I had her from the beginning.
Yeah, that's sort of a dream, right? It's every writer's dream.
It is, but I also feel like, you know, when you're doing the right thing and you're on the right track, the universe kind of greases your wheels.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like suddenly I was like plucked out of the drugstore drinking a milkshake and became a big star. I mean, you know, like most people, there were other books before that and lots of writing and lots of other things leading up, you know, to my career. I just turned 51 years old and I just published my first book. So it's not that it, you know, it was like this dreamy thing that happened overnight.
Yeah, that's so excellent. Well, you know, I was wondering, you know, and this is sort of an ongoing conversation I seem to have with myself and sometimes with others, but it seems to me that memoirists are so able to put themselves on the page and be honest about what they're going through, whereas maybe fiction writers need to, maybe we need to sort of couch all that in other characters and in situations so that readers don't know it's us. But can you talk about that? Have you always been an essayist, memoirist, nonfiction writer? And is, I guess it's a two-part question, and is being honest on the page, does that come easy to you, or do you struggle with that?
That's such a great question, and it's a huge question, Barbara. Well, first of all, I bow down to people who can write great fiction, because that means that all has to come out of your own mind. And in a way, I feel like being a journalist, it's great training for memoir, because it's the story is there. You just have to put it into words. So I didn't really have to make up any of the memoir. It was there, and I just had to tell the story. But the part about putting yourself out, and this is a book, and it has a lot of conflict, and it has a lot of people bumping up against each other. And I feel like it's a memoirist responsibility to take the hit. So for anything that goes wrong, because I'm the one writing the story, I'm the one with the luxury of this platform. And so I feel like it's really important to not make and just as in life too, you don't want to make every problem everybody else's fault, because there's really like no introspection. So every place that I could make myself, I'm going to put this in quotes, the a-hole, I did, you know, and I really tried to see, you know, what was my part in this problem? What was my part in this conflict? Whether it was with the birth parents or with my ex-husband, or anything, or any, you know, relationship, or my parents in the book, I really tried to examine, what my part in it was, because I'm the luxury with a platform to do that.
Yeah. I guess that's the other thing. And that is new writers deal with worry about offending people. What's my husband, my ex-husband, my parents, what are they going to think? And so as I was reading this, I was wondering where you were with that, how you were navigating those worries with, you know, what would your ex-husband think when he read the book? What would the birth parents think? How did you deal with that? Or did you worry at all?
You know, I'm actually still dealing with that, and I would say it's a really difficult position. I mean, you have to balance honesty, I guess you have to worry about people's feelings as well. Really sadly and tragically, my ex-husband died in January before he got a chance to read it. The book does discuss our marriage and the demise of our marriage and the drinking issues around that. And I told him in advance, I said, you know, you're not going to like it. It's going to be, you know, I do talk about personal things. I tried to be respectful. And again, I tried to take the blame, you know, for my part in anything that happened. And he said, you know, I think he got that. And he was very sick and getting sicker over the summer. And he said, you know, just as long as the readers understand that Grace has a dad and that he's engaged, that's what I care about. And so I did take that as a blessing. He did not get a chance to read the book before he died. And understandably, his family is uncomfortable with it as well. So, you know, I think there is a cost, and there is a cost to telling the truth, and there is a cost to telling truth that is not pretty.
Well, I would love to hear you read from Rock Needs River. Would you do that?
I sure will. To tee this up, the first part of the book talks about me becoming a mom and that very, very long and messy journey. And I am visiting my brother in Israel, and basically I haven't, like, nothing's really worked out for me in terms of a relationship or having a baby. I've had three miscarriages at this point, and just no prospects, no nothing. So this is where the scene opens up. We went to Jerusalem for one of the last days of my visit. I wanted to inhale the ancient city, thick with history and color and spices. I took hundreds of pictures in the old market, where I meandered through stalls selling chess sets, spices arranged into precise, immaculate towers. 10 years later, I still have some saffron that I use, pinch by tiny pinch, and charms to ward off the evil eye. Ilya and Golly needed to deliver a suitcase to a friend of a friend, a nun named Sue, at the Russian Orthodox convent of St. Mary Magdalene. We drove up a steep hill toward the church's gleaming golden domes, one of the highest points in the city. I felt a little sad that I was not of this denomination, that I didn't have the faith that the religious tourists did. Sue, originally from California, had become a nun after being miraculously cured from cancer by drinking goat milk. Her cell phone kept going off with Ave Maria as the ringtone. I loved her instantly. At the church, a docent led us on a tour and lectured in English about the ochre-red Russian Orthodox Easter eggs lovingly depicted on the walls. The color symbolizes the blood of Christ, the shell, the impenetrable tomb from which he emerged. I wandered around and admired the art, the fine craft work, the ornate devotion of the believers. At some point, I found myself alone outside the church's small cemetery on a scrubby patch of grass high above the city. I looked down over Jerusalem, a jumble of bricks and people and donkeys and shopping and layers of history too old and complicated for my little American mind to comprehend. And then there was a voice, not a voice of anyone I knew. It wasn't male or female or high or low, but I heard it clearly as if someone next to me were speaking. The voice said, "It's okay to ask for miracles." There was nobody next to me, nobody around me, but I know it happened from outside me. I double-checked. Nope, nobody there. It felt like the opportunity of a lifetime, as if I had won a $1 million sweepstakes but had to make a speech in order to claim it. My brain reached around the concept of a miracle. What did I want most that was the most unlikely thing to occur? Make it good, I told myself. This is your chance. It hadn't occurred to me to ask for any miracles ever. In fact, I'm usually a little afraid to pray because I don't want to use up too many favors. What if there's a fire or a similarly urgent situation that takes up more prayer karma than I have left? What if God is busy and doesn't get the message and it just doesn't happen? What would that mean for my ambiguous faith if my prayers failed to manifest? But it seemed that I had gotten permission from someone, somewhere, and I wasn't going to analyze it too much for fear that I would talk myself out of it. I'd tried so hard and failed so many times to make a relationship that led to marriage, that led to a baby, even skipping straight to making the baby. I was out of plans and out of answers and out of options. And suddenly it was okay to ask for miracles. So I asked quietly, "I would like someone to love me enough to have a child with me, please." I half expected something significant to happen, but the ground didn't move. There was no clap of thunder or a sudden surge of swallows, not even a rustle of the breeze or a dropping of a leaf. But for no outward or logical reason, I did feel an inner knowing that my order had been received, stamped, and was on its way to processing.
Lovely. Thank you so much. That was Vanessa McGrady reading from Rock Needs River, a memoir about a very open adoption published by Little A. And I must say, you're such a good reader.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. That was lovely. Your writing is so visual and sensory, and I'm wondering if that comes right away. Is that one of the things that you do easily, or is it the second, third, tenth draft that it's really imbued with all of those kinds of details?
You know, I actually don't know, and that's a good question. I write, I feel like you, when you were a journalist and you're a content journalist, so basically, you know, really most of my bread and butter is writing health articles for websites or personal finance things, and you really kind of have to scrub all of the flowery purple stuff out of that. But then when it comes to a book like this, you have to really reset your muscles and your mind, you know, to write, to be more descriptive and to be more visual. And I feel like that is, it's something that gets easier the more you do it, but I feel like I had to kind of train myself to write like that, because I'd never really written anything like that before.
So when you're going sort of between writing the bread and butter money writing and your memoir, is there anything you do? Was there anything you did? I mean, are there rituals? Did you go into a different room in the house? Did you go away? What would you do to kind of get into that different head?
So, you know, there were so many different phases of writing this book. I feel like when I really had to sit down and, you know, just deliver something and do the nitty gritty, I would only work on this from 9 to 12. So I'm a single mom and I drop my daughter off at school. And so then I would come home, make my tea, make my breakfast, and then only work on this from 9 to 12. And I think that was probably the most productive part of it. And then also when she was visiting her dad, she would go away. She would see him every other weekend. And so I would have those 2 days to, you know, A, kind of just recharge, but also to work on, you know, big sections of the book. So I feel like I do better if I have a dedicated chunk of time to do that.
Yeah. I'm also curious. Well, I'm curious about so many things, but we only have a limited amount of time. So I'm trying to figure out what I want to talk to you about in the 10 minutes we have left. And one of them is, how do you feel about readers who, after meeting you, or upon meeting you, feel they know you because they read your memoir? I mean, should they feel that way, or is that kind of faulty thinking?
Well, I mean, it's all pretty much in there, and I didn't leave anything out. It's very personal, and it's really interesting to hear from people I already know, because they said, oh, you know, I kind of knew that, but I had no idea about this part, so... it's funny because I just assume that people I know everything, but they don't. And they kind of got, you know, a timeline and a trajectory, and they've known me from different parts of my life. And so they got that from the book as well. And then I guess I've heard from really lovely people who have read the book and sent me an email. And I would just say, if you ever like a book, just send a quick note to the author, because it's such a joy to see that it has touched somebody or it has inspired them to do something. And that's been really lovely as well, to just hear from people I never would know otherwise.
Yeah. The late, great Carolyn C. in her book on writing, Making a Literary Life, talks about, you know, the charming little note that every day you should write a note to somebody. And who better than a writer? I think a lot of readers, even writers, feel that they're infringing on a writer by emailing them or sending them a note. And like you said, I mean, we love it, right? You want to know people are reading your book and they're affected by it.
I mean, I would say the most, there have been two that have really stuck with me. One is, I wrote a piece in Refinery 29 it was Jezebel, and it was about miscarriages, and it actually ended up in the book as well. But Anna Quinlan sent me a note on that, and we've sort of had like a little bit of we had a little correspondence after that, and that was just really blew me away. And also Tom Juno sent me something, and I was like, oh my God, am I being punked every time I heard from them? But it was really like just such a lovely gesture on both of their parts to reach out and you know, and just say, you know, hi and congratulations and, you know, I like your work. So that was really a thrill for me.
Yeah, that's perfect. Did you keep journals throughout this whole time?
I did, but I didn't keep them very well. I also don't have a great memory, which is a terrible attribute for a memoirist. So some places I did have a journal. Like leading up to the adoption process, and I really meticulously journaled you know, when I went to the meetings at the adoption agency and when I was kind of in and out of it with my ex-husband. And then, you know, a lot of this stuff has just recreated, thankfully, from messages and emails and Facebook posts and stuff like that with Bridget and Bill, my daughter's birth parents. So, you know, it's funny that even though we don't keep traditional journals all the time, so much of what we do have is preserved from, you know, our social media or from our electronic communication that can be used to recreate it.
Mm. Yeah, that's a really good point. And printing out emails and, you know, I mean, it's like we used to have letters, right? And some of us still do, especially if we use typewriters, as I do. We have letters going on. But with email, you know, you don't think to print things out.
Well, you don't. And actually, I don't print a lot of things out. But even, like, going through pictures and, mm-hmm. you know, like, I would look through my pictures of, well, what was happening when Grace was 2 years old. And, oh, yeah, this day that we were at the park with them, that happened before this other thing. So it was just, it's just super helpful to have that, like, digital archive of your life when you're working on a memoir.
Yeah. Are there memoirs that have influenced you? That you turn to?
Oh, my gosh, yes. So many. You know, and it wasn't really until, I mean, I've always loved memoirs. I loved, Lucille Ball has had a memoir many, many years ago. And she's, you know, she was amazing. And but also recently, I kind of feel like it's the golden age of memoir because we have people like Stephanie Land with Made and Tara Westover with Educated. And they're not really even like celebrity memoirs. They're, you know, real life. Priest Daddy is another one. There's like real life crazy family and, you know, getting through hard times and overcoming these obstacles memoirs that are so good and so fascinating. And I finished Educated last night and I was just flattened by how much, just how amazing Tara Westover is in this, you know, after like not ever going to school and mm-hmm. then, you know, getting a doctorate and becoming this incredible writer. I'm continually inspired and I feel like this perpetual memoir student, even though I'm already done with mine. I keep studying it.
Well, will there be another, do you think?
I don't know. You know, people have asked me that, and I feel like things are so fresh and just so, there. You know, there's still trouble and there's still a little bit of turmoil. The birth parents are not in contact with us right now, and that's their choice. And then Peter, my ex-husband, has died. And so, I mean, there's still, I don't know, it feels like you need to let things settle a little bit before you write about them. Mm. So maybe. But I don't have a plan right now.
Well, as we draw down on our time, do you have any advice for the memoirists listening?
I would say that keeping a journal is a great idea. And I would say keep it electronically if you can, because then it's so much easier to transfer it over. And it just makes it easy. And then just keep thinking in scenes. Just keep thinking, just show, you know, show it, don't tell it. And I do think most people have a story in them.
Mm. Vanessa, thank you so much. I really appreciate you being here.
This has been really lovely, Barbara. Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. That was Vanessa McGrady. Her book is Rock Needs River, a memoir about a very open adoption, published by Little A. I'll be right back with Glenn Eric Hamilton. Don't go away.
Such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you turns my whole world misty blue. Oh, just the mention of your name turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby. I think of the things we used to do, and my whole world turns misty blue. Heaven knows I've tried. Baby, when I say that I'm glad we're through, deep in my heart I know I've lied. I've lied. I've lied. Such a long, long time. Looks like I'd get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you, my love, my whole world turns misty blue.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from UCI in Irvine, California. And if you just tuned in and you want to catch the beginning of the show, go to iTunes, subscribe to the podcast Writers on Writing, and when we podcast later this week, it will arrive in your podcast file and you can listen from the start. And as well as this show, there are hundreds upon hundreds of other shows we've done over the past 20 years. Soon to be 21 years, there to listen to. And the archive is also at writersonwriting.blogspot.com. If you can't find it on iTunes, go to the archive and you'll find it there. I am back with Glenn Eric Hamilton. Glenn won the Anthony, McCavity, and Strand Magazine Critics Awards for his debut novel, Past Crimes, which was also nominated for the Edgar, Barry and Nero Awards. A native of Seattle, Glenn grew up aboard a sailboat and around the islands, marinas, and commercial docks of the Pacific Northwest. He's president of the Southern California chapter of Mystery Writers of America, and he's here to talk about Mercy River, published by William Morrow, which releases on March 12th and has already received a starred review from Publishers Weekly. Hey, Glenn.
Hi, good morning, Barbara.
Great to have you on.
Thank you.
Let's talk about Mercy River and how the book came about.
Sure. Mercy River is the fourth in the series of Van Shaw novels. Van is something of an unusual beast. He was raised by his grandfather, who was a professional thief. And with the skills and the moral compass skewed that would require, he escapes that life into the military and he serves with distinction for 10 years. And really, the arc of the series is his return to civilian life, or at least to be as close to being a straight citizen as someone like Van can handle, and his walking the line between a sense of justice as well as the trouble that a man with his background seems to find himself in quite a bit. In Mercy River, We see the return of a character that we've met before, Leo Pack, who's probably Van's closest friend from his days in the Army Rangers. Van receives a call, and Leo has been arrested for murder in the remote town of Mercy River in central Oregon. Van rushes to help, but soon finds that the town, that Leo was there as part of a gathering of hundreds of special operations veterans who are there for an annual raucous party and a charity drive called the Rally, which is run by a decorated special ops general. Both the town of Mercy River and the Rally itself have some pretty dark secrets that they would prefer Van not stick his nose into, but of course, as usual, he finds himself on the bad side of dangerous people pretty quickly.
Mm. Wow. So how much of the story did you know going in?
A reasonable amount. I had wanted to take Van out of his usual environs of Seattle, which is my hometown, as you said, and put him in a landscape that was markedly different. And I had seen Central Oregon many years ago when traveling through, had wanted to spend more time there. It gave me an excuse to go up with my daughter and do some location scouting. And I had also known of the Army's Ranger gathering that they throw every 2 years called the Ranger Rendezvous. And I had a notion of, well, what if there was a private West Coast version of that that was a little more unhinged? And what would come of that? Especially if it was founded for charitable but maybe somewhat secretive reasons along the way. So I had a pretty good idea of the milieu that I wanted it in and the location and his reasons for being there. And then the rest of the story evolved fairly organically from that.
So you did not have an ending?
I did not have a concrete ending, no. Once I determined what the secrets behind the town were and what it was trying to keep hidden, then the ending presented itself. In other words, once you usually know what the question is, you can figure out the answer.
Huh, that's really interesting. You know, I'm so curious about growing up aboard a sailboat and around boats and islands and marinas. Talk about that a little bit and how that has influenced your writing life.
Oh, absolutely. You know, people who live aboard boats, rightly or wrongly, see themselves a little on the outskirts of things, right? They aren't completely integrated into what you would consider normal society. And I think that viewpoint on the world has certainly flavored the books, has certainly flavored my own life and Van, of liking to be, you know, communal, but maybe a little removed from things along the way. There's also the advantage that you get to see the city and the islands and docks and so forth from a different angle than most people ever do. You know, you have a different form of freedom when it comes to living on board a boat, and a different type of work that has to be done too, because there's a lot of work involved in living aboard. But you do see things from a different angle, and Seattle is literally surrounded by water, including the sky above, which is almost always drizzling. So it, when you have a city like that that's bounded in that way, you know, still it's the second largest shipping port on the West Coast. It's still one of the primary import-export hubs for the United States and for America as a result. That lends itself to a lot of crime, a lot of change, for good or ill in the economy, and a pretty fascinating environment.
What brought you to LA?
Primarily work. And also the fact that I had lived in Seattle for my whole life. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to wake up in my elder years and realize I had never tried to live somewhere else. I had worked for the same company for quite a number of years and thought, you know, now's a good time to leave. My wife is an actress, and so we thought, well, why don't we go try living in LA for a while? And ironically, it was moving away from Seattle and then coming home and seeing how rapidly the city was changing that made me want to write about it, that made me want to set books there.
Interesting. And so Past Crimes, your first novel, you won so much. I mean, it was nominated, it won various awards. Was that the first book you wrote or the first book you published?
It was the first book I wrote with an asterisk, because that book, I had started writing classes and I had been part of a sort of a professionally run writing group, you know, hosted by an established mystery author. And the book itself went through a number of lives over the course of about 4 to 5 years of writing it along the way. So while Past Crimes was the first book I worked on, there were probably 3 different versions of Past Crimes that were written during those 5 years or so.
Interesting. Well, I would love to hear you read from Mercy River.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Got about a 3-minute segment here. This is early in the book. Van has just received the call from Leo, and he's talked to the law enforcement in Mercy River to find out what's going on, and he's enlisting a little help in the dead of night. So, I found the right house, a long modernist structure with 2-story glass windows. I knocked twice and rang the bell. Lights inside popped to life, and after a moment, the lamp above me on the front stoop followed along. "Who is it?" a voice hollered from within. "It's Van, Ephraim." Ephraim Gans opened the door. It was a large door, which made Gans appear even smaller by comparison. He wore yellow silk pajamas, perfectly fitted, each cuff the precise length for his limbs. As if in contrast, his sparse gray hair stood up in electric tendrils from sleep. "Sorry to wake you," I said. "I don't believe you are. What is this, kid?" I let him have the kid. Ephraim Gans had been my grandfather's criminal lawyer since before I could remember. Even now, edging out of middle age and into his senior years, Gans had energy enough to power his whole mansion if you stuck plugs in his ears. "You remember Leo Pack," I said. "He's been arrested for murder and robbery in Mercy River, Oregon." "Honey?" a woman called as I stepped inside the foyer. The very grand foyer, 2 stories and a staircase. I glanced up past the railings to see a flushed and pretty face with ash blonde ringlets framing it. Her eyes widened at the sight of me. "It's all right, baby," Gans said. "Just a client." She didn't seem reassured. Viewing the scene from her side, 4 o'clock in the morning, a big guy dressed like a handyman standing in my front hall, with scars like pale creek beds creasing one full side of his face, I wouldn't feel too secure either. "Ma'am," I said. She frowned and disappeared into the shadows of the upper floor. "Third wife's pretty," I said to Gans, too low to be overheard. "You are still on number 3, right?" "Funny," he said. "What's this about your sniper, buddy?" He did remember Leo. I told him the situation. He listened without expression, interrupting only to clarify exactly what the deputy had told me. "The arraignment's later today," the county cop said. "That's not a good sign. They think they can close this fast." "Yeah, I need you down there," he sighed. "Come on." I followed him to a kitchen half the size of a tennis court. All of the appliances along the walls were of gleaming burnished steel, a match for the sleek lines of the house. It made the kitchen feel a little like a morgue. "Leo," Gans said as he took out a jar of instant coffee and 2 delicate china cups. "He's the one with the troubles, right?" He tapped a fingertip against his temple. "And he's been arrested before?" "Yeah. You know how this is going to look. You take a suspect with a record, a history of mental instability, that says something. Leo's got post-traumatic symptoms. So do I, and so do half the guys I know. His Army service record, that'll just reinforce what the prosecutor wants, Van. The guy is trained to pull a trigger. More than that, he's among the best in the world at it. A Special Forces sniper. Special Operations. Forces are the Green Berets. We're Rangers. Oh, pardon moi." He finished stirring and handed me one of the porcelain cups. Loose ground swirled grayly on the surface of the mixture. I looked at Gans. "I got a taste for Sanka in law school," he said. "Living in the coffee capital of the U.S., and I drink this." "You get Leo sprung, I'll buy you a tanker truck full of it," I said. "Add one and one, Van. Unless the cops screwed up the chain of evidence, we've got an uphill battle ahead. So let's go," I said. "I'll send Aaron now. He's good." "Ephraim, how much of a retainer did I give you?" Gans rolled the coffee around in his mouth. "And I never asked how that miracle happened. From all your overtime as a bouncer, I'm sure." "Pack a bag," I said. "What, right now?" "My truck's outside." "We're driving there? God save me. Your grandfather never gave me this much grief. I knew him 30 years. He ran a hand through his wild hair. "Mercy River. Tell me that name isn't meant as sarcasm."
Thank you so much. That was Glenn Eric Hamilton reading from Mercy River, published by William Morrow. Your point of view, your voice is so strong, and this first-person point of view, I want to talk about a little bit about the advantages and difficulties of writing in first-person past tense.
Sure. The the biggest advantage I see is I do think it's often easier for new writers starting out to write in first person, and that is where I started along the way because the viewpoint is so limited. But then as you grow as a writer, hopefully you realize the, as well as the disadvantages that gives, and that you rarely know more than your protagonist knows. But there's also advantages in that, too, of being something of an unreliable narrator, having the person's viewpoint be limited or wrong in their way. And it's this distinct advantage, not only in mystery, but I think in character development. As a character is wrestling with something, you can really show why they're wrestling with it and maybe give hints as to how their perspective on the world is not quite what other people are seeing.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting. And I'm also curious, which I think it goes hand in hand with your strong point of view character, is balancing narrative with scene. And I think of scene as something that can be filmed, and so that we see the story as it unfolds. Although narrative maybe is the little islands that connect the scenes, the bridges. Talk about that. I don't know if you even think about that anymore, since you're beyond your first novel. But you have such a nice balance here of narrative with scene. Is that something you give thought to?
Well, yeah, a little bit. I often feel that if I understand what each character's point of view and motivations and approach to trying to get what they want is in the scene, the narrative tends to take care of itself. You know, characters are going to jostle for position, they're going to try to drive things along the way, and they're going to force the story in a different direction. It doesn't necessarily mean that I have no control. I have a lot of control. I'm not the sort of writer that says, well, the character took this direction and I had no choice over it. that's not the case, for my writing anyway. But there is a way of saying, well, if I put these three characters together and they're all arguing for their points of view or not, as the case may be, maybe they're working on the sly, who wins that exchange and what comes out of it and what has to happen because of it, right? And often if I'm thinking about what characters who aren't in the scenes, the villains, the side characters, and the moves that they're making and the actions that they're taking, that often dictates what's going to happen to Van as the lead going through this. Because if the villain is making moves of their own, they're going to come back at a particular point and cause trouble.
Interesting. Okay. What about...
I hope I answered your question.
No, you did. It's just giving me more to think about. What about theme then? Because in your book, you're dealing with crime, injustice, loyalty, betrayal. You're dealing with so many various themes that my guess is you're not thinking theme. That theme is something that the readers decide. But maybe you are.
I'm never thinking theme in the first draft. I'm usually writing the story and letting the story come out. And it's generally in rereads and rewrites that I discover what the theme is and reinforce it along the way. You know, for example, the theme to past crimes, which I didn't figure out until late in the game, is forgiveness. It's about forgiveness. And because the Van and his grandfather have a falling out when Van is 18, and there's a wedge between them for a decade or so, and Van realizes not only that he's ready to bury the hatchet, but that his grandfather has been doing particular things to try to mend those fences as well, in Van's absence, and make things right. And so that wasn't apparent to me in the first writings of the book. It was only really when rereading the manuscript from back to front that I realized, oh, okay, this is what this story is about, right? And I usually find that with each book accordingly.
Hmm. So you mentioned rewrites. How many revisions do you typically put a book through? Like, how many did Mercy River go through?
Mercy River went through two, one of them significant and one lighter, rewrites before I turned it in. And then it went through another... fairly light one after I received notes from my editors, both in the U.S. and the U.K., mostly to reinforce certain character points of view and to make sure that we were clear as to Van's motivations in doing particular things. But they weren't significant rewrites. On my second book, I had much more significant rewrites, largely because it was my second book and it was the first one I had to write on a solid on a real deadline.
Mm-hmm.
But the rewrites there were all subplot related. They were not part of the main mystery, which was solid as it was. They were really to get the subplot in the right place, and that was, interestingly enough, largely to reinforce the themes of the book and give the main story the proper resonance by working on the subplot.
Talk about subplots. I mean, that's an interesting aspect of, plotting or actually giving a novel, texture.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you decide which to keep and which to let go?
I try to keep a subplot if it reinforces the main story, not just by adding more complications and more things for the characters to do, but in complicating it from a both a thematic and emotional perspective, right? If a character really has to be at a particular location at a particular time, but they're called by their estranged spouse who needs help at that, to conflict with that, you've got two plots going on there. You've got the reason they had to be in that location, which might be the main drive of your thriller, and the emotional subplot of how they're dealing with the ex-spouse, for example. So there's an example of it adds complications, but more than that, it adds richness to the character and more resonance to the main story.
Mm, yeah, that's a good one. That's a good
subplot one. Doesn't do that. You probably don't need it.
Right. What about writing a series? Did you know you were going to be doing that?
Originally, when I very first started out writing Past Crimes, I thought it was a standalone. But very fast, before the first, I think, run-through was even really finished, I figured out that, no, this is a series character, both because there was a lot I wanted to explore about Van and his background, but also because I just really like the idea of assembling a large cast of characters gradually over time and then seeing how they bounce off each other in different ways. That's a lot of fun, because you can bring in characters from previous books, as I have with Leo in this one. You can circle back and find out where those characters are in their lives as they're progressing, and really just sort of build a rich world over time. Interesting enough, I kind of think of it, to put it in a televisual perspective, a good season of television very often has sort of a novel like structure where you're meeting a lot of characters, you're exploring what they're doing. They might be in a totally different adventure from season to season, but there's generally an arc that they're following along the way, and we see how not only our main characters, but a lot of revisited characters have to adjust to that or have to deal with those consequences. And I like that aspect of books too, and it's it allows for a lot of expansion of your world into areas that you might not have first thought of to go.
Yeah. Who are your influences, your literary influences?
Oh, wow. well, growing up on a sailboat, the challenge there is that sometimes the wind doesn't move and the boat doesn't move, and so I would raid my parents' books much earlier than I probably should have been doing. So I would say probably the foremost one would be John D. MacDonald's Travis McGee novels,
mm-hmm.
not only because of the boats, but just because McGee, like Van, is a character on the outskirts of what's considered acceptable society, and he makes his living helping people who might not have other recourse, and that had a lot of resonance, and certainly there's a lot of that in the Van novels as well. Robert B. Parker's Spencer series, of course. Patricia Highsmith's The Talented Mr. Ripley
has
great lessons in the unreliable narrator along the way. And some of the really classic whodunits too, from Agatha Christie and others, I just adored. And I usually call the Van Shaw books mystery thrillers because there's almost always some sort of whodunit or mystery that Van has to solve in the course of this, and he has to figure out clues, and I try to play fair with the reader, of course, always, in providing them with the same pieces. But it's a thriller because generally people are shooting at him by some point in the story or other trouble.
So, you know, we have a couple of minutes left, and I wonder if you have any words of wisdom for the novelists who are listening.
Of course. You know, obviously, perseverance is the biggest thing, right? You need to keep plugging. It's important to celebrate every victory. You finish a chapter, hey, treat yourself to some ice cream, enjoy it. You know, if you get a good rewrite, or if you get a great idea and you've got that down on paper, celebrate that, because, you know, the victories are tough to come by, and they're often really far apart. The biggest advice I can give is if a writer, especially a new one, is not in a writing group, try to find one, try to assemble one, take some classes. Find the people in that class who are really good writers, whose work you respect, and see if they're interested in creating a writing group. Try to punch up. In other words, find writers that are a little better than you are at particular things, and learn from them as you're all working together on this. It also helps because if you're meeting every week, if you want to write a novel and meet every week and bring 5 to 10 pages, that weekly deadline is really useful.
And you do not have an MFA?
No, I don't have any degree in writing at all, but back in reference to the writing groups, if you're treating a writing group appropriately and you've got a lot of talent in the room, I kind of thought of my writing group as getting a master's degree 10 pages at a time.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. Vanessa, our first guest too, you know, she's been a writer forever, and you know, there's your MFA when you're writing and you're meeting with people and you're reading, you know. I like to support that. I think that's so important.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's a you know, if you're surrounding yourself with good writers, and you're learning from them, and you are you know, able to set your ego aside and kill your darlings when you have to, your craft will progress. There's no question about it.
Glenn, thank you so much for being
absolutely
on the show.
Barbara, great talking to you.
Great to talk to you. That was Glenn Eric Hamilton. His book is Mercy River, and it's published by William Morrow. That's all the time we have today. Come back next week. We'll be here. And in the meantime, go to iTunes. Look for Writers on Writing Podcast. Subscribe, and you'll have access to all of our shows, which we look at as your own personal MFA program. Thank you so much for being here.